Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, Braden and I are going to discuss a leading political personality in South Dakota's history, Gladys Pyle. If you have not heard of Gladys Pyle, well, you should have. And we have done several things over the last few years, but certainly across the last few decades in the Historical Society to publish about her and to try to make her more known. Braden, we're going to spend some time talking today about her and her life and impact on South Dakota and the nation. We have had the opportunity to listen to an oral history interview about her, so we'll be using some of that oral history. And then also there's a few articles that have been published in the South Dakota History, our quarterly journal about South Dakota's historical events and people and places. And then her home in Huron is on the National Register. And there's a brief write-up about the family that lived in the house in Huron. So we've kind of cobbled together some things because, unfortunately, she's certainly a person who could have a biography written about her, certainly is deserving of a freestanding biography about her. But so far, that's not happened. Well, let's set the scene a little bit for Gladys Pyle. What was her birthday? Let's just start at the beginning. You know when she was born? And kind of how she got her start in life?
Yeah, Gladys Pyle was born October 4th of 1890 in Huron. She is the daughter of John L. Pyle and Mrs. John L. Pyle, Mamie Shields Pyle. Ben and I are kind of laughing because that was an important sticking point for Mrs. John L. Pyle. She preferred to be called by that name. You know, she didn't want to go by Mamie Shields.
Yeah, Mamie Shields Pyle or maybe, yeah, there's, we'll get into that in a little bit about her, but what did her dad do?
Yeah, I mean, you could almost say that Gladys was destined for the political stage, or at least the civil service. Her father was the Attorney General of South Dakota, and he's actually one of the first, I believe Doan Robinson, in his History of South Dakota, talks about how he was the first South Dakotan to die while in state office. I believe he was on up in Helena, Montana, getting ready for I believe there was a joint prosecution that they were going to do against one of the railroad companies.
Okay.
Catches the flu, and when he comes home, he ends up passing away. But John L. Pyle, Attorney General of South Dakota. Her mother, Mamie, or Mrs. John L. Pyle, she was a leader of the women's suffrage movement.
Yes, she was.
A powerhouse there in South Dakota.
Yeah. An organizational powerhouse. There's been several things written about Mamie as well, and how with being a widow with four young kids, managed to organize the suffrage movement in South Dakota that ultimately puts it across the finish line in 1918, when the state approves, effectively, the voting men in the state vote to allow women to vote, which occurred in 1918. After five previous unsuccessful tries, women's suffrage finally passes at the state level in 1918, and largely because of Mamie's political acumen and talents, it gets across the finish line. It's kind of difficult. Well, there's two major things going on at that time among a sea of others, but relevant to this issue about women's suffrage. Women's suffrage and prohibition of alcohol were inextricably linked in the minds of the voters, largely because many people who were for women's suffrage were also for prohibiting alcohol. And it became you have to vote for one or the other. Often the women's groups, the political groups, the organizations that would organize for suffrage would also organize for prohibition. And in the minds of the typical male voter, it became to be seen as synonymous. They were the same kind of thing.
So she kind of grows up in this life of civil service, you know.
Gladys does, yes.
Yeah, Gladys, right. Yeah. She's getting pushed for this the entire time. And she ends up attending Huron College, which was previously Pierre College, I believe.
That's right. Yes.
Was moved. Her father was instrumental in helping to get that moved.
Yeah. So
she attends there. She gets a liberal arts degree with an emphasis in music.
Yeah.
We'll go on to take some graduate courses at the American Conservatory of Music in the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
But then she returns to Huron. She starts teaching high school civics. And that's in 1912. A few years later, in, I believe, 1919, she becomes the principal in Wessington, South Dakota.
So it's clear she has some organizational talents because they make her
right.
principal.
And she holds that position for 2 years before she heads out to be a lecturer for the League of Women Voters, going around the nation and talking to people about several different issues, but, you know, citizenship and voter participation, and trying to inspire that civic pride that I think is a hallmark you see throughout her career.
Right. Well, definitely listening to that interview that she gave in 1979, her civility, her articulate nature, her ability to tell a story, to chuckle at herself, she's a very charming, gracious lady, and that's not something that she would just acquire in her later in her old age. But you can tell that she was raised that way, and that she had been that way all her life. And despite a fair amount of, well, she got heavily involved in politics in the next stage of her life that we'll get to. But despite all of that, she never says anything negative about any of these people. She, in her description of that, she'll tell you who were the people doing the good things and the kind things and the proper things. She'll use their names, but she doesn't use names to talk about who's doing the skullduggeries.
Right. Well, and she always is heaping praise on those around her. And you can get a real sense of her character from these oral history interviews. I mean, she seems like just a fascinating gal.
Yeah. She leaves being the principal and she heads off to go do what?
Yeah, she's doing these civic lectures and as she's going around, she she said in her oral interviews, I did quite a lot of citizenship lecture, and really that's what finally got me as I was trying to encourage women to participate. Then I began to think, well, do these lectures apply to me or just my audience? And that's the reason I decided to run for the legislature.
Right. So she runs for the state legislature in what would have been 1922. So that might have been probably the second opportunity for a woman to run if they could vote in 20. After suffrage passes in 1918, they could have voted or run in 1920. So running for the state legislature in 1922 is still a very novel enterprise for a woman to run for the state house. What was the reaction to her candidacy?
I think for a lot of people, it was kind of mixed. I mean, even her mother was frankly kind of against it because she thought, this is Mamie Pyle, or Mrs. John Pyle, she thought that people might think she was just trying to cash in on the work that she had been doing, that Gladys was just going to ride her coattails.
Right.
There is a feeling of, she talks about her time in the legislature too, that no one was ever mean or picked on her. but there was a sense of disapproval that it was just a new space. And I think people were, didn't know really how to respond to it.
Yeah. I think there were, she does say there were several people who treated her in a gentlemanly way, but then also some others who kind of, well, just like you said, or like she said, didn't know how to respond to that. She gets in and she represents Huron, or that Beetle County was probably your district.
Well, we should talk about her actual first election, I think.
Yeah, let's dive into that. That'd be fun.
Difficult, I think, is the best way to describe it.
It is, yes. So, and later she'll run for governor. So it's also difficult to kind of disentangle similar issues that were going on at the time. But
right.
There was a primary law that was existing in South Dakota at the time that no longer exists, because the Richards primary law, which was put forth by
Richard Olson Richards.
Okay, so if you forget that last name, you've forgotten the first name too.
Right, yeah. He went by R.O. Richard.
Yes, R.O. Yeah. Richards was kind of in the progressive Republican strain of the party. And it's important too, maybe, to back up that this, might as well get this out of the way first. But the Republican Party in South Dakota was kind of split three ways. There were the progressive Republicans that modeled themselves largely after Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt's wildly popular in South Dakota. And Governor Norbeck would represent that political line of thought and activity and ideology within the Republican Party. Then there were the, Gladys called them the stand patters. We might call them the conservatives, that kind of the Taft wing of the Republican Party at the national level. And then in the state level, they were definitely a minority within the GOP. But then there was Gladys's wing, which were the independent Republicans. And I think some of that time, as you read about her, sometimes, well, I've seen in places where people say that she declared her that she would be an independent and run, but that's missing the what's going on. It's the independent is the adjective of Republican. She's part of the Republican Party. She's just in a certain slice of the Republican Party that doesn't necessarily want to claim to be progressive and doesn't necessarily want to claim to be the stand patters. She was independent of all of that. And so she declares herself to be an independent, and at the convention, there's a lot of confusion about that and which wing she's in and so forth. So that kind of hits her both times. But then also this primary law, when she's running in 22, makes it also complicated. And what's the snag there?
Well, she ends up losing at first.
Yes.
So they do the election. The votes come in and Gladys has lost. And it was noted to her by a few of her other Republican colleagues who, I think Gladys goes on to say that she thinks they liked her because she had some fight.
Yeah, that's right. She says they had some respect for her because she would stick up for herself. They thought that was admirable and she had some fight. That's right.
Right. So. They key her in on the fact that some of these votes were not counted correctly. And this goes back to the Richards law. And so people were getting counted twice. And so she does end up winning after challenging the results and getting the recount done. She ends up winning by 350 votes.
Okay. So she goes from losing to a huge landslide. Well, maybe not a huge landslide, but goes from losing to a modest victory.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and this makes her the first woman elected to the state legislature in South Dakota.
Right. And that's really, this begins her, a series of things that she will be the first woman to do. And so she joins the state legislature then in the early 1923 for this two-year term. And then she's reelected for another two-year term. And what are the issues that she does in the legislature?
Yeah, she starts working on the child labor amendment, getting that ratified. She's known for advocating for women to serve on juries.
Right.
That hadn't been a part of South Dakota law. And, you know, she even talks about how, quote, "I think most of your judges now prefer to have something, especially certain types of cases. I think they would prefer women on the jury and the ratification of child labor." So she saw this as, you know, we have the right to vote.
Right.
Now we also should be represented in the courtroom, you know, a jury of one's own peers.
Yeah. Yeah. She says that it's a jury of your peers. Well, there's no women on there, and you're a woman that's being accused or involved in this case, then it's more likely to have peers if they're of the same sex.
Right. And again, it's that civic engagement and getting people to be a part of their community,
right,
to work together. So she's doing that. In 1926, she became the first woman elected as South Dakota Secretary of State.
Right.
And during her time in the legislature, she'd served as the Deputy Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
So she's, I mean, becoming a mainstay in right. South Dakota's government during this time.
Yeah, and all this is, again, it's kind of through the GOP of the day and the Republican Party. Then after she wins this, which Secretary of State's important because it's a statewide election.
Mm-hmm.
In South Dakota, at the time, the governor, lieutenant governor were elected, the attorney general, the Secretary of State, school and public lands commissioner. These folks are statewide elections. The treasurer is a statewide election. And at the time, the superintendent of public instruction was also a statewide legislature, so, or election. So by being in this job, you'd get your name on everybody's ballot across the state as they went to the polls and kind of elevate your name recognition in a time when, well, in the early 20s, people are, it's getting more common for folks to have radio in their home, but it's not a given at this point. And so reading about her in the paper and so forth is more likely to do that when she's campaigning for a statewide office.
Right. And so she'll hold that job, Secretary of State, for two terms. So from 1927 till 1931.
Yeah.
But in 1930, she has a kind of larger announcement. She's trying to go a step further.
Yeah. She was encouraged to run for governor. And now she's not the first woman to run for governor. There was a nonpartisan league candidate in 1922, the same year she ran for the state house. That woman came in a close, very close third place in a three-way race. And that was probably the most votes a nonpartisan league candidate ever got in South Dakota. It wouldn't last too much longer. Most of those progressive sentiments migrated their way into the Republican Party. A few probably went with the Democrats, but I think most of them went to the Republican Party. Norbeck and other leaders in the GOP were very cognizant of what was going on with the nonpartisan league, watching what occurred in North Dakota with a very active and successful third party in North Dakota, which the Norbeck and the Republicans didn't want to have happen in South Dakota. And so they, like a lot of parties that tried to big tents, they folded a lot of their NPL agenda into the Republican Party's agenda in 1920. So, yeah, 1930, she, it's kind of a series of events that weeds out other candidates that were seen to be most promising. Certainly the stepping stone to running for governor in South Dakota is serving as one of its members of Congress, or as lieutenant governor, or as attorney general. Those are kind of the three, you know, launch points for a gubernatorial campaign. But for reasons that we won't get into here, those guys weren't going to run. And so the Republican Party was kind of scrambling for candidates. And she thought, well, okay, I'll give it a whirl. And and she goes for it too. I think part of the whole scene, though, in the politics of that 2030 gubernatorial race was this banking scandal that was being investigated by the sitting attorney general, who, because he had this controversial case he was prosecuting, the man who ran the state's insurance activities, farm insurance and so forth. And the thinking was that, and the accusation was by the attorney general, that he was corrupt and he was malfeasant and he should be prosecuted. However, he had a great reputation. So a lot of people didn't think. A lot of people were accusing the attorney general of just having this case in order to make a political name. So that's part of the reason, at least that's what he told Gladys and the other Republicans, is that's why he wasn't going to run, because he needed to concentrate on this. He knew he had a case. He was going to prove it in court. And if he was going to be governor someday, he'd run later, which he did. And he won. But not 1930. So the attorney general is kind of out of it at that point. And Gladys then gets in the race. And the Richard's primary law has now been, by this time in 1930, is no longer the primary law. But there's still some confusion, isn't there?
Yeah. So, well, one thing that I think is really interesting about how she ran in the primary is that she refused to take the campaign trail. She said it was as her responsibilities as Secretary of State. She needed to be in peer working on that. So she didn't go out to towns, really. She was a lot more focused on newspaper editors, state GET delegates, GOP county chairmen, and sending them letters and writing into newspapers. And that's how she was really getting her name out there for the primary. And it was, her campaign was centered on banking reform and tighter control of state funds. And she really surprised quite a few people by winning more votes than any of the other primary runners.
Yeah.
But she didn't get the 35% required by law to be the candidate.
Right. So, and by the 35%, these are all done in convention, right? This is
right.
Republican Party leaders and precinct leaders and so forth showing up at a convention and doing a round of ballots until somebody hits this magic 35%, and then they would be the nominee.
Right. And Gladys only captured 28% of that vote, which in a four-way race, you would...
Yeah.
You look at that and would think, oh, doesn't that make me? But according to the rules at the time, they needed 35%. So a special state GOP convention was held in Sioux Falls. And from there, things get a little wonky for Gladys.
Who are the other candidates then, these three other guys? They weren't nobodies, right? I mean, they were all...
No. One of them is Brooke Howell. We've got Warren Green.
Warren Green, he'll become, well, he gets the nomination then above her, doesn't he? Warren
Green. Yep. And then I believe is also former Governor Carl Gunderson.
Yes, okay.
Was the other fellow running.
Okay.
So, I mean, Gladys was going against established GOP Republicans, you know.
Right. These aren't
GOP
pushovers.
Party members, and was doing really well.
Yeah.
And it comes down to about 12 rounds of voting, because no one throughout the convention is able to topple that until finally Howell steps out and endorses Green.
Okay. That's usually what it takes, is when somebody realizes they're not going to get it, then they throw their support behind somebody else and that throws it over. So,
right.
She has a description about that, though, in her oral history tapes, where she had won the, she thought she had won the vote, and there was some confusion kind of on the floor as the ballots being mentioned, and somebody lets out, Green has won, and they were still counting the votes, and so it wasn't, I don't know if that's some skullduggery there, pushing, you know, one of Green's staffers or aides pushing him prematurely in order to get a few more votes across the line, but she didn't seem to describe it that way. We might we might assume something like that's going on, and something may have, but she, in 1979, so many years later, as she's describing that event, she had nice things to say about Green, actually, didn't she? She didn't blame it on him. She didn't think he was crooked or anything like that. So,
right. But I believe after this, she decides that she's going to wash her hands of partisan political office, and she says no more.
No more. Yep. She had been working in the insurance industry in Huron. And so then she got herself named to be the on the South Dakota Insurance Commission while she worked for the Milwaukee Insurance Company in the region, and was, I guess, setting herself up to do that for the rest of her life. When in 1938, another opportunity to get involved in politics happens. This is kind of another odd series of events. She can get into that. But what happens in 38, Braden, that gets her, she runs for another great office.
Yeah, she runs for partisan office once again, yes. This time for the U.S. Senate. And so it all kind of comes to a head when in 1936, I believe, former South Dakota governor and then senator for South Dakota, Peter Norbeck, dies.
Yeah. Dies of throat cancer, I think, and in office. And that the governor, who's a member of the Democratic Party,
Governor Barry, yeah.
Yeah. Appoints Hitchcock to be the senator to fulfill the rest of the term. And Chan Gurney from Yankton is lining up to run as the Republican in 1938 for that mm-hmm. Senate seat. Hitchcock decides he doesn't want to run for the U.S. Senate seat. He throws his hat in the primary for the nomination for governor, right? Hitchcock's kind of out of the picture for the 38 race. And because of that, Chan Gurney, who wants to run for the term that starts in 1939, can't run to finish Hitchcock's, formerly Norbeck's, time in the Senate.
Right. State law at the time required that the individual who was the interim senator had to step down after the next election. But it also said that you couldn't have your name appear twice on a ballot.
Yes.
So part of this has to do with FDR and the New Deal.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, America is still kind of coming out of the Depression, still is in the throes of it. And
yeah,
so there's rumbling.
Yep.
So there's still rumblings of, well, maybe FDR is going to hold a special session
right.
At the end of 1938. And so in South Dakota, there was a push to hold a special election to replace Senator Hitchcock, because there will be about a 2-month gap where yep. South Dakota won't have a senator. Because of the law that says you can't have your name on the ballot twice, Gurney can't run for that spot. And so the Republican Party is kind of scrambling to look for someone who will run for that 2-month senatorial position.
Yeah. And so Gladys says, okay, I'll do it. And she wins easily. And it's kind of a special, well, it is a special election. And everybody who votes for her knows that her term will terminate when Chan Gurney or whomever wins that seat arrives then in March of 39, but FDR had held to combat the Depression. FDR had frequently held special sessions of Congress, and they wanted, and the GOP leaders wanted to have their seat represented. And I think South Dakotans wanted to have two seats. The other senator at the time was Bulow, who was a Democrat senator from South Dakota. Interesting fellow, Bulow. He didn't like FDR. So Norbeck did like FDR, and he was the Republican. And Roosevelt was decidedly not a Republican. So it was kind of a strange set of circumstances there. But Gladys runs and wins. And so she becomes the first woman to win election to the United States Senate who had not been previously appointed. There was about three or four other women who finished the terms of their dead husbands in the U.S. Senate in history. And so you have to kind of put all those qualifiers on it. But it is something to say that she earned her stripes through the state's politics as in the legislature, or Secretary of State, and then that won the special election to become United States Senator. And in those 3 months that she's in Washington, there is no special session called. So she does work some issues, constituent issues for South Dakotans. But then when Chan Gurney shows up to start his term, she heads back to South Dakota.
Well, it's noted, too. I mean, she's lobbying with the Works Progress Administration. She's lobbying the Department of Interior on behalf of South Dakotans on reservations and trying to help them with ruined crops. She's working with Norwegian officials to schedule the Crown Prince and Princess to come through South Dakota.
That's right.
During their North American travel.
Right.
She gets a lot done in 2 months.
Yeah, she's quite the dynamo. I mean, she's not letting off the gas and or taking her foot off the accelerator by any stretch of the imagination. And I think that those things that you just mentioned there are perennial issues. Lobbying on behalf of Indian reservations for a wide variety of things that when the federal government is not complying with the treaty obligations they have. Seeing the Norwegian royal family and talking to the Norwegian ambassador is something that's part and parcel of South Dakota politics due to all the Norwegian immigrants that are in the state. That's certainly something that's part of our culture and history. And she's making sure they're aware of that. And then she does get invited to the White House, which sets up a really good kind of incident that she has. She gets invited to the White House. There's a black tie dinner. The Roosevelts, Mr. and Mrs. Roosevelt, invited her. And she sends out her clothes she's going to wear to get cleaned, which include long white formal gloves that a woman would wear to such an event at the White House. And when they come back from the cleaners, she's about ready to step in the car. She getting dressed, she realized she has two left gloves and no right glove. So now she's stuck.
I'd be panicking.
I'd be panicking too. I'm supposed to be dressed in these things. I can't show up representing South Dakota looking like some country hick. You know, I got to be dressed properly. But she comes up with this clever little way to kind of get around it. She puts on the left glove and she takes the other left glove and just holds it in her left hand. And she walks around holding her glove in her hand. And when she goes to the receiving line with the president, she just tells people, I just want to shake with the president's hand with my hand. And so people kind of, okay. Nobody figures out that she doesn't have a right glove. But that's a pretty smooth way to kind of, you know, on the fly, get around this little fashion faux pas and still go to the party. And by the way, Mrs. Roosevelt asks her, they sit down to dinner. And during the dinner, Mrs. Roosevelt says, well, we'd like to hear from the senator from South Dakota. Because she was, I'm sure, she was very proud that there was a woman in the United States Senate. And so she wasn't prepared to make any remarks. So she gives up she stands up and makes a few kind remarks. She didn't say in that interview in 1979 what she said in 1939, but evidently passed muster. So representing well, and that demonstrates her classy nature and quick thinking acumen and all kinds of social scenes from the White House to the State House and so forth. So one thing she says, though, about FDR, and I'll just say this as an aside, she got kind of sick of all these programs that were coming out, and not necessarily that the program was good or bad or that programs per se were bad, but she said the way people talked about them, this was the beginning of an acronyms just coming out of the government left and right, the CCC and the WPA and all of this, and she, as a person who was very articulate and enjoyed language, she knew that acronyms can become impenetrable to people who aren't aware of them, aren't familiar with them. And she thought it was, as political leaders, that they should be speaking in plain English. And I would agree with that.
Right. Well, and yeah. I think she has experience with that, too, in the ERA, an acronym that I'm sure she wouldn't right. like us exactly. using, but the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yes. The Equal Rights Amendment. And I think when this recording was, this oral history was done in 1979, the Equal Rights Amendment had been passed by Congress and sent to the states to ratify. And so to add to the Constitution, it must be, they have to get appropriate votes in both houses in Congress. And then it goes to the states, and you have to have 3/4 of the states ratify that. And to do that, you need to have all the state legislatures then, or there might be a slightly different process in each state, but the ratification process is up to the state legislature. And the state of South Dakota in 1970 ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, which, as Gladys would say, was the simplest thing in the world, the way she phrased it. She says it's the simplest thing, Gladys said. And the way the Equal Rights Amendment reads is, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." There was another sentence that said, this amendment, as it does for nearly every amendment to the Constitution since the Civil War, this amendment shall be, Congress has the authority to pass laws to enforce the amendment. Basically, they get to pass laws that kind of round out the details about how all this should be done. But at the constitutional level, you try to keep it straightforward, simple, clean, clear, and so forth. South Dakota ratified it in 1970, and Gladys says it was utterly silly not to pass it. And it got held up in a lot of southern states. And Gladys says about the politics in the South that she says, quote, "Southern men are more courteous than fair to their women." Which I thought was, there's probably some truth to that. At the time, this was in the 1970s when she says this. And so there was a lot of confusion about that. And listeners may recall that South Dakota later rescinds its ratification. And a few years ago, the Attorney General of South Dakota had to go to the Supreme Court and ask and defend South Dakota's right to rescind it. There was also this ability that Congress had extended the deadline for states to ratify it. And Virginia and other states ratified it after the extension was done. So part of that South Dakota case was already also in the details of the original ratification was supposed to be done within a certain amount of time and hadn't been. So there's kind of two things there. But in any event, I'm sure if Gladys were around today, and as she told the person on her oral history interview, as I said before, it's utterly silly not to pass it. And she also tells this story, too, kind of going back about a century and a half. She raises the reality, and I've seen this in other places, that women's suffrage movement that really begins in earnest in the 1840s in the United States has a direct correlation to the abolition movement. Mm-hmm. And the same types of ideas that wanted to facilitate the rights of people not to be slaves is also informing the same moral motivation for the ability of women to vote.
Right.
And she talks about some incidents that happened in England and the United States that kind of informed women working on abolition. Then when that was finally accomplished in England, early 1800s, and then later in the United States in 1865, 6, 7, and 8, and so forth, with the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War, that the women's voting rights really became front and center for a lot of people after that. So they're keeping up their head of steam on that issue. So let's kind of wrap up here. She's, as we said early on, Gladys grows up in this really accomplished and amazing family. She has three siblings, two sisters and a brother. Both, they're all accomplished people. One goes on to become a mathematics professor. One's gets involved in medicine, I think, and really quite the family. She has a lot of ties around the country, as you might imagine, with her work with legal women voters and time in politics. And well, one more thing, though, before we wrap up, maybe we ought to talk about, we told the audience that her mother's name was Mamie, but she preferred to be called Mrs. John L. Pyle. And maybe that needs a little bit of an explanation before we go. I think when I was growing up, I'll put it that way, back in the 70s, I can remember getting letters from my grandmother, and she would say Mrs. Raymond Bauer. That was her married name, Mrs. Raymond Bauer. And I asked my mom, why doesn't she say Gladys? Gladys was my grandmother's name, too. My mom said something along the lines of, well, that's her married name. It's kind of de facto married name. And my mom used to do that convention, too. You don't see that around much more. But Gladys brings that up because in this oral history interview, which was done in 1979, the interviewer is asking about her mom and her dad and so forth. And I'm not sure. The interview was done by a college student from Wisconsin whose family, he had family ties in South Dakota that are pretty clear. But I'm not quite sure what we missed at the beginning of the tape. It was done on an old cassette tape and so forth. I think there's a little bit of discussion and he pushes the record button a bit late. But what is clear is that Gladys Pyle knows that her mom always referred to herself as Mrs. John L. Pyle. And she was, in Gladys's terms, proud of her marriage and that she didn't think it was a kind thing to do, because in one publication, it had said Mrs. John L. Pyle, and then they changed it. And Gladys says, I don't know if it's those now women or what, but they changed a publication, and I don't know why they can do that. Why can they change something that's copyrighted from Mrs. John L. Pyle to Mamie Pyle? And she never chased that down, but clearly she's kind of upset on behalf of her mother for the publication to change something that her mother had chosen her name and how she wished to be referred to. So...
Right. Well, I think it illustrates the change just in the 20th century.
Right.
Between the different women's movements, the progressive era women's movements that care about, you know, suffrage, that care about temperance, that were born out of the abolitionist movement, and this women's movement that comes in the 1960s, 1970s, that is, I think, more focused on the individual and that individual's maybe societal rights. I don't know if that's necessarily
this might be a whole nother podcast and maybe more philosophical than historic, but I think it is. It's called, in the history business, we would call this presentism, where you look at something like Mrs. John L. Pyle, and it's in an old document, and you assume that Mrs. Mamie Pyle wouldn't want to be called that. And so you change it for her. This is what got Gladys mad, is that somebody else later on, well after her mother has passed away, had changed the very name that she wished to be called on behalf of her. Kind of a paternalism or maternalism, I'm not sure who, but or how exactly, but a choice that takes away Mamie Pyle's agency about her choices and the motivations about the choices. And the person that changed it may have thought, well, she probably wanted to be called Mamie, but she wasn't because of the convention of the time. Well, that's an assumption that's born out of a presentist understanding of what, in this case, I guess you could call her a women's activist, would want. So now, we're probably going to get all kinds of mail about this. I don't know, but we'll see. We'll see how this goes. Two guys talking about women's suffrage movements and women's identity. Anyway, I'd invite anybody to listen to that interview and not that oral history interview, which we will link in the show notes. and people can listen to that for themselves. There's some of that on the first tape and a little bit that gets interrupted, unfortunately, on the last tape where they try to come around to it. But
well, and all the tapes are fantastic, and there's transcripts with them, so
yep,
they're worthwhile listens.
Yeah, the audio is worthwhile to listen to because you get her sense of decorum, civility, graciousness, and just a classy lady, all the way around. Well, what do you think is the impact of her life on South Dakota and the nation today? Braden, what would you say?
You know, she had a quote that I think is just brilliant and sums it up in one line. And she said, citizenship is service. I think she was just gives us a platonic ideal of, you know, what a South Dakota citizen should be. Someone who cares about her state, cares about the people in the state, is breaking boundaries to help people in the state. She is just an inspiring lady.
Yeah. Yep, all the way around. Anything we can do to make her more well-known is great. We encourage people to visit the home in Huron. The Pyle House is there and can be visited. We'll put some things, other things in the show notes about Gladys Pyle. Well, Braden, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.